Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Let others obsess only about the horse race. We continue our election series, 30 issues in 30 days, all this week on the theme of inequality in America. And today on a different kind of inequality, issue 14, who sacrifices when the United States is at war? The volunteer military, really a professional military, puts the risk of war on a relative few compared to the randomness of the draft. Remember when Senator John Kerry said this in 2006?
You know, education, if you make the most of it and you study hard and you do your homework and you make an effort to be smart, you can do well. If you don't, you get stuck in Iraq.
Ouch. And what about the sacrifices of those who don't serve? Does the majority of America feel it personally at all when our countrymen and women are dying for our nation? And should we? Our first guest on this is Kristen Henderson. She's a journalist who writes frequently on military issues, including her reporting from Iraq. She is also married to a Navy chaplain currently serving with the Marines, and she is author of the book While They're at War, The True Stories of American Families on the Home Front. And she's also communications director for the Yellow Ribbon Fund, which is a nonprofit that helps injured service members and their families. Kristen, thanks to you and to your husband for your service, I think it's fair to say, to the whole family, and welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you.
So you have a chapter in your book called Different Planets, which you begin with a story of your conversation with an electrician working on your house in Washington who just couldn't get enough of watching the Iraq War on TV when your husband was there. Do you remember that and why it had an impact on you?
Yeah, I think that was the moment that it crystallized for me, the gap that has grown between military and civilian. He was there working on some wiring in my house, and he knew my husband had done the work on it. And he, you know, kept saying it would be really helpful if we could call him. And he did not know my husband was deployed at the time. I didn't necessarily make a habit of telling people because you never knew what kind of reaction you were going to get. It's always been politically polarized, and when you have a loved one deployed, I personally don't have a lot of energy for a political discussion. But I finally admitted to him that my husband was in Iraq, and he said, "Wow, that is so cool." You know, he was rushing home to watch. It was on the news all the time during that period, and he was rushing home every night after work to watch the live feed, you know, in color as it was happening. He said, "Last night I stayed up all night watching a firefight, and it was so cool because I didn't know how it was going to turn out." He said, "You're watching it too, aren't you?" And I kind of went, "A little." But, you know, honestly, I wasn't watching it much because, my concern for my husband was a fear that was constantly whispering at the back of my mind, you know, every waking hour. And if I'd watched the news nonstop, that would have just amplified it to a shout. So finally he said, "I can't wait to go home and tell my wife that I met someone whose husband's over there with all that technology and equipment. It's just so cool." And I just wanted this very nice man to get out of my house, because for me it was life and death, and for him it was a video game.
But you write in that section that alienation comes in many forms during a wartime deployment, including alienation from civilian society. So did that go much further for you than that electrician who somehow didn't seem to get it?
It's kind of variations on that same theme. It was when I was talking with a neighbor. I was living in a civilian neighborhood, and she had found out my husband was deployed, and she said, very thoughtfully, she said, "What is that like to have your husband over there?" And she admitted that she did not know anybody else with someone, with a loved one on active duty. And that was when it hit me that, you know, less than 1% of the military serves, so of course most people don't know what it's like. And in past wars, a much higher percentage of the population served. You know, I think it was 11 or 12% in World War II, even 4% in Vietnam. You know, so you didn't need books. People knew what it was like, and now they don't.
Was there something that our country should have been asking people like that electrician or the rest of us, other than following the war on TV and pulling for our side?
You know, what they need is practical support, on many levels. And I think it's because the experience of having a loved one in a war zone is very much a death by a thousand cuts experience. It usually is not some big trauma you can point to. But there are many different stresses that accumulate. The first one was the one I alluded to earlier about that fear in the back of your mind all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When I was researching the book, I was talking to the chaplains on Fort Bragg, and they said they'd seen, as the war was growing, they had seen this wave of grief go through the spouses who'd been left behind on base. And they said they realized that they were essentially suffering from the same symptoms as people who have a loved one with a terminal illness. It's called anticipatory grief. And as they ticked off the symptoms, I realized, you know, that during my husband's last two deployments, I had had many of these same symptoms, including insomnia, crying jags, an anxiety attack. I was sitting in church one day and just had this overwhelming urge to get up and run out, which had never happened to me before. I was crying in the shower so that no one would know. And I thought I was just a little crazy. And I was imagining the funeral. That's another thing that's very common. You know, you're imagining that knock at the door and the funeral, but you think you're nuts. And it turns out that's just a normal reaction to an abnormal situation.
Yeah, I would say.
And just giving it a name is very helpful to know that this is temporary and normal. But so that's the emotional piece. And then on the practical side, you know, if you're a parent, suddenly you are a single parent, and there are single parents who handle this with grace every day all across this country, but for these young military families who move every couple of years, they don't have an established network of support everywhere they go. And so suddenly you're a single parent with all the responsibilities heaped on you. Your children are probably also very stressed and showing signs of that. You may have financial pressures as well because you've had to cut back on your hours at work to make up for, you know, all those responsibilities at home. If your loved one's a National Guard member who's been activated, their military pay generally is less than what they were making in the civilian world. So again, you have financial pressures there. So it's just these accumulated issues, and it goes, deployment after deployment. Now, I also don't want to make it out to be an unending nightmare, because it's not. As you overcome these things, it's very empowering. And it does build resiliency, and yet that also contributes to the gap because, you know, a friend of mine the other day was complaining wistfully about her husband being gone for a couple of weeks on a business trip and how stressful this was, and I'm thinking, oh, please, you know, he's safely in a hotel somewhere.
Right.
You know, so I'm feeling superior. For her, it is a very real stress. It's just a different experience.
But to pull it back to the theme of our 30 issues segment, is there something more as you're going through all of this as a military spouse that you want from society, either from the government at a policy level or just from other civilians at a private level?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you certainly at a policy level, the big thing I'm seeing right now, particularly with our injured, are the burdens that are on the family caregivers who wind up dropping everything when they have an injured service member. And rushing to Walter Reed or Texas, wherever they're being treated. And they usually have to quit or are fired from their jobs. There was one mother who was fired in the lobby of Walter Reed by her boss, who made the trip to do just that, while her son is upstairs in ICU fighting for his life. So then after a couple of years at their bedside in the hospital, because these recoveries take a long time, they have a big hole in their resume, and they're going back home and trying to find a job. And if their service member is now a disabled veteran, they may also be the primary caregiver. And, there's no safety net for them. So I'd like to see the same job protection for them that National Guard troops have, you know, that their job is, mm-hmm. is held for them when they're called up.
My guest, Kristen Henderson, military spouse, journalist, communications director for the Yellow Ribbon Fund, a nonprofit that helps injured service members and their families, and the author now of While They're at War, The True Story of American Families on the Home Front. And listeners, how do you think the rest of the U.S. should be sacrificing when such a small percentage of Americans seem to shoulder most of the burdens in wartime? Reinstate the draft? war bonds? What, if anything? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Now, on the role of the civilian sector helping veterans after they serve, here's a short but fascinating exchange between Stephen Colbert and Michelle Obama on Colbert in April, talking about the Join Forces program that connects military families with jobs and other resources.
I have only one criticism, is that it's joiningforces.gov, right?
It is .gov.
It makes it sound like, you know, big government. Is there any way we can help the troops in the private sector?
Absolutely. Our motto is everyone can do something. So this isn't big government. Government has a role to play, but it can't do everything. Everyone has to step up in ways big and small.
So how about that thought for you, Kristen Henderson? Not Colbert's joke, but the serious part from Michelle Obama. When it comes to the civilian sector during wartime, everybody can do something.
Yes, and absolutely they can. As I alluded earlier, the employers can be more supportive of their employees. It's really the least we can do, living in the benefits of this country, when an employee has a loved one who deploys. And if you happen to live in a neighborhood where you know someone who has a loved one who's deployed, you know, one woman talked about how she was lying there with her husband overseas, and she was thinking, oh, I really have to get up and mow the lawn. And this was after being up all night taking care of other issues. And then she heard the lawnmower going. It was a neighbor mowing her lawn for her. You know, respite care for these sudden single parents can be a big help, you know, just offering to take the kids for a day. And professionals are doing the same thing as well. I mean, there are lawyers who are providing pro bono services for veterans. There are mental health care providers who are joining various organizations to donate time. Because while the military is providing quite a bit of support services for members of the military and their families, there is still some stigma attached with finding mental health care. So being able to do it anonymously out, you know, in the civilian world is sometimes more appealing.
You know, I have no idea who you support politically for president. You can say if you want or not. I heard you before when you said when your husband is deployed, you have no stomach for political arguments. But are the presidential candidates attuned to the issues that you raise in your book?
I think more so than they were when I wrote that book during the previous administration. Yes, I think there's been a vast improvement. We still have a long way to go. But at least it's part of the conversation now. There's a real recognition.
And do you see them as different on this from each other?
The two current candidates?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I think it's telling when it doesn't come up in an acceptance speech for a nomination to be commander-in-chief.
Kristen Henderson, military spouse, journalist, communications director for the Yellow Ribbon Fund, a nonprofit that helps injured service members and their families, and the author of While They're at War, The True Story of American Families on the Home Front. Thank you very much for joining us.
It was my pleasure.
And more on A Different Kind of Inequality coming up in a minute. Who fights America's wars and what is asked of the rest of the USA? Issue 14 in 30 issues in 30 days. Stay tuned. We have a military historian coming on next who predicts a crisis in military-civilian relations. And we'll ask if you would support a reinstatement of the draft. Stay with us. Brian Lehr on WNYC. It's our election series, 30 issues in 30 days, all this week looking at issues of inequality in America. More now on the different kind of inequality we're talking about today. Who fights America's wars and what is asked of the rest of us? Issue 14 in 30 issues in 30 days. Here's a clip of Jesse Jackson, who I interviewed during the Democratic convention. I asked him if he is in favor of reinstating the draft.
Absolutely. We should share the burden and share the glory. People ask, why have there been so few protests over the war in Iraq and the war in Afghan? Because so few people have some child or some family member in the game. It's basically a backdoor draft for a poor people's war. In the war in Vietnam, children were leaving Harvard and Yale, and some leaving Columbia and Ohio State. And because of the broader distribution of pain, the broader protest. And so we should all share equally in the burden and the glory of America.
Jesse Jackson, who I spoke to during the Democratic Convention. With us next is military historian Richard Cohn, professor emeritus at the University of North Carolina. Civilian-military relations has been one of his main areas of concern. Professor Cole, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And listeners, again, we invite your phone calls on how you think the broader country at large could support the effort when the United States is at war, or do you think we should reinstate the draft, as Jesse Jackson does? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Professor Cohn, do you think the civilian-military relationship is different in the last 10 years during the Iraq and Afghanistan war era than it was before?
I don't think it's all that different, except that the American people, I think, have expressed a very clear and vocal support for the armed forces in this effort. The relationship is always at the top of the government between the senior military and the political leaders, somewhat tense. They come from different worlds. There's some distrust, I think, between the two. But more broadly, I think relationships in society are pretty good so far. I mean, we've tried to take care of the troops. We've got a much better GI Bill in terms of benefits for people who serve. And I think there's a genuine respect. The old animilitarism and blaming the soldiers for what happened, which was part of Vietnam, really began to wane in the 1980s.
So if we go back even further and compare today to what happened during World War II, when basically every male of a young adult age who was physically fit enough went to the front, do you think sacrifice and risk are more concentrated today in a much smaller segment of the population during other wars in our history? And are there consequences to that?
Well, there's no doubt about that, because during World War II, we were mobilized completely as a society. We had rationing, limitations on civilian ability to buy things, and almost every family was affected. But today, of course, we have an all-volunteer force. We don't have the same threat that we had in World War II. We don't have the same need for large numbers of people in the services. And we're a different society. If we had a draft today, we would be drafting women as well as men. There would be far less need for that great number of people. And so there would be no way really to share the burden equally. And a draft in American history has never been fair, to even with a lottery. Some people have to bear the burden and some people don't. And the American people...
But the randomness of a lottery does impose a certain kind of fairness, doesn't it?
Yes, I agree with that. The old system of deferments over employment and student status and whether you were married or not, whether you had children or not, what was indeed very unfair. But if you get right down to it, some people are selected and some people are not. And you can't share the burden. Even in World War II, you couldn't share the burden because some people were exempt because of their employment and other people for physical or mental legal problems. It just doesn't work. And I don't know what you would do with the huge number of people who are physically and mentally fit.
Let's take a phone call. Kathy in Long Branch, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Love your show.
Thank you.
The guy is right. My husband was in the military during Vietnam. He didn't go there, but he went to Korea. And he, you know, not during war either, but like the lady before, I had those night sweats, woke up one night knowing he was killed because he was near the DMZ. But anyway, One of the things we can do individually is to help these troops. These guys have to buy their own stuff. Now, I don't know if there's commissaries over there or what, but, you know, they don't get paid much, as he says, and they have to buy everything they need, their daily needs. And they're not paid that much. They're supporting their families at home. They're trying to support themselves over there, like my husband did when he was in Korea. And I tell you, that's rough on families. So what we have in Jersey is this thing called AIM, and it's a group of people out of, I think, Lakehurst.
Mm-hmm.
And they're helping the families and the troops with food, clothing. They give them supports. They help the families, you know, to go to various and sundry places. I'm not sure if they help the guys when they come home. I'm sure they do.
Uh-huh. So that's a great program to alleviate some of the financial burden on the families.
Exactly. And then the other thing that we do in our church is our parish collects food and daily supplies both for the troops and for the families. And we give it to AIM, and then they literally, and that's another thing, you can also send them money. They ship these things out, boxes, to all the troops all over wherever they are, and they did do in Iraq as well.
Kathy, thank you so much, and that's an inspiration. Professor Cohn, on an even broader economic question, as they try to help individual military families, another relic from World War II was war bonds, which mm-hmm. seems quaint to try to go around selling bonds to the American people so there's more money to spend on the war. But we fought for a decade in Iraq and Afghanistan with borrowed money. This comes up in the presidential campaign now because the deficit is such an issue. Mm-hmm. What about more direct requests of the American people to support the wars in that way if the physical risk is being spread to such a small group?
I think that's an excellent point, Brian. There's no question that we have been fighting these wars since 2001 without a request to the American people to sacrifice or to contribute in a meaningful way. And it's really important, I think, to the people in the military. It's an issue of their morale and their ability to keep fighting and put up with the difficult times. I think the calculation of the Bush administration was we have to kind of go back to normal so that the terrorists don't think they've won. And there was something to be said for that point of view. But the war bonds in World War II were not just to raise the money. They were to involve the population and to understand that they had to sacrifice because sacrifices were being asked of them. And so I think it is a good point. What really surprised me in this last 10 years is that the national leadership has not even gone to the American people and encouraged military service among all groups, whether you're going to a college or whether you're just coming out of high school. We do have to encourage that.
Richard Cohn, military historian, my guest on WNYC, as we continue with issue 14 in our 30 Issues in 30 Days series. As inequality is our theme this week, this is a different kind of inequality, concentrating the burden of wartime on such a small segment of the American population. And here are clips from Obama and Romney on ways that they want to do more for veterans who are back from the wars looking to crack the job market. This is the president last November proposing tax breaks for hiring vets. Congress later did pass this proposal.
Connecting our veterans to the jobs they deserve isn't just the right thing to do for our veterans, it's the right thing to do for America. But there's still more that we can do to encourage businesses to hire veterans. And this week, Congress will have another chance to do the right thing. They'll get to vote on those tax breaks that I proposed back in September for businesses to hire veterans. Members of Congress will get to say whether or not they think it's a good idea to give companies an incentive, an additional incentive to hire the men and women who have risked their lives for our country.
The president last year, and as I said, Congress did then pass that proposal. And here's Governor Romney proposing a specific way that he would expand the GI Bill.
I'll also modify the post 9/11 GI Bill so that any veteran wishing to continue his or her education is eligible for in-state tuition regardless of residency. And to make it easier for veterans to find employment in skilled trades, I'll work with the states to create a common credentialing and licensing standard and encourage organizations to recognize and grant credit for military training.
We heard Obama. We heard Romney. Let's hear John in Woodbridge. You're on WNYC. Hi, John.
Hi. How you doing?
All right.
I just want to say I love your show.
Thank you.
When it comes to this, I mean, I'm 26 years old. My birthday actually just recently, 2 days ago. I've always wanted to join the military since 9/11. I never got to because I had parents that told me go to school, go to college, now go to law school. And now I'm out, 25, graduated both universities. Now I have no idea what I want to do. I know that law is not the answer. Military is the answer. However, at the same time, the only reason I'm interested now in the military is the education benefits and, you know, being able to go back to school and learn more. Because let's face it, the country doesn't need another attorney. It needs somebody else with better minds, engineering, science. And see, the problem is the military, as a country, we keep proposing hearts and minds. Well, how do we do with M16s? We should be more of a military that's more interested in the cultures and the countries we're going to, trying to figure out exactly what are our similarities, what are the differences, how do we work together.
So you want a more educated military?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I have to name drop Jacques Fresco of the Venus Project because, I mean, he discusses this as well, where it's just, you know, we need to just go overseas, be more educated, be more involved, but not be so strapped, I guess, armed.
Mm-hmm. John, I really appreciate it. Please call us again. So, Professor Cohn, related to John's call, you wrote an article that included a proposal to replace ROTC on college campuses with something else. And I think we all make an assumption that most kids at more elite universities just have no interest in the military, and you want to challenge that, don't you?
I do. I think we need to have a much broader range of people serving in the military, and I think if we ROTC is an expensive business, and it's limited to a few, you know, several dozens of schools among the services. If we were to go to the American youth and to say, look, if you will serve as an officer in the military, we'll give you a full ride scholarship to whatever school you wish to go to, and you serve in the reserves during your time in college, so you understand and learn what it is to be led as well as to be a leader, and then serve for 5 years, I think we would get a broader group of people going into the military. And more important, we'd scatter them all over colleges. And it's the roommates and the friends of these people who need contact with people who are in the military. And a lot of students will go to the best school they can get into. They'll go to private schools because there's this, I think, mistaken belief among a lot of college students that if it costs more, it's better. And I think we would save a lot of personnel and a lot of overhead that we use for the ROTC right now in a military that really is stretched, or will be when the economy recovers, to recruit adequate numbers of people.
Of course, we do have the military academies, and I wonder if having a replacement for ROTC on more elite campuses does anything to spread the risk in a more equitable way, because chances are people who go through those officer training programs aren't going to wind up like the privates, if you will, to taking the same kind of physical risks.
Well, it depends on when and where in their careers. I mean, officers at the young age who are in the ground forces do, in fact, share the risks with their enlisted people they lead. But by and large, it isn't as dangerous. But that's not really the point. Mm-hmm. You really serve in the military. You do difficult jobs just because you're not at risk of being killed more in different jobs doesn't mean it isn't service and it isn't absolutely critical to the success of the armed forces.
Dan in Sussex County, you're at WNYC. Hello, Dan.
How are you doing today? My thing is, I think your question is wrong as far as military service. I think it should be a national service administration where everybody from the age of 18 to 35 is put into a CCC or a WPA-type program, and those that wish to go into the military go into the military program, but everybody gets trained to be military-ready, and it's across the board. No deferments for anybody, any reason, and that's all I have to say.
So in that scenario, Dan, you would have everybody go through military boot camp, even if their service work is going to be building roads or something?
Oh, yes. They would have to go through some sort of boot camp training, and then you would have a pool of people throughout the society that are ready and able, mm-hmm. with an extra training possibly, to get out there and do what has to be done if it's necessary. And that would prevent I think we should go over the war over here, because when you get the population out there at risk, the politicians begin to listen when they got their sons, yes. and daughters and grandchildren on the line.
Dan, thank you very much. And Professor Cohn, that was Jesse Jackson's point in the clip that we played, that there was less protest around the wars of this generation than during Vietnam, because not enough families had their own skin in the game. And so it's easier for politicians to engage in military adventurism, either for political purposes or because they think it's right. Do you agree with that point?
Well, I have a different perspective, Brian. I really think that the political leaders go into war with very serious calculations, and they don't do it on the basis of, well, we're not going to get protests. The reason we had protests in the Vietnam War is that the war wasn't successful after 2 or 3 years, and there was no clear exit from it, and no way to get success. And I think we would have the same thing in Iraq and Afghanistan if there had been a draft. It wasn't a question of going to war. It was a question of whether we were succeeding and we had a strategy that would provide success for the national interest. So I think that's really the key to this. Your caller has a wonderful idea, and that's some kind of national service. And that's been proposed several times in American history. The problem with it is its practicability. If we were training every man and woman of military age, I don't think the U.S. Armed Forces would have either enough people or enough time or enough resources to really even do that, much less engage in the other military tasks.
I wonder if there was national service, mm-hmm. if it would do something to close this civilian-military gap or make people feel more responsible for the country and the troops who are serving, even if it's a small percentage of population at war. I don't know if that's the case, but this idea of universal national service comes up, as you know, from time to time. President Clinton proposed it when he was first running for office, and it made a certain group of Americans' hearts go pitter-pat, the idea of some kind of national service. And people, as the caller was saying, would self-select for which ones wanted to go into the military and who wanted to go into Teach for America and whatever else is out there. But then Congress said it was too expensive, too much big government, and shot it down. And we got the much smaller national service program that exists to this day. John McCain ran on universal national service, but he didn't win and probably wouldn't have gone anywhere if he did win. What do you think about that as a central organizing principle to try to keep front and center?
Well, I think Congress indicates really where the American people are. They don't want the government kind of seizing their children for 2 years or whatever length of time it is. I think it would have enormous benefits in terms of cohesion, in terms of teaching citizenship, in terms of the communitarian aspects of American society that we have really lost in this last 30 years of hyper-individualism and selfishness. But again, the practicalities of it are really enormous. The cost and I think the resistance of the American people and probably to many employers, too.
That is our 30 Issues in 30 Days segment for today. Our theme all this week, inequality as a theme in the presidential campaign. And today we looked at a different kind of inequality, the small group of Americans who bear all the burdens when the United States is at war. We thank Richard H. Cohn, Professor Emeritus of History and Peace, War and Defense at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We appreciate the conversation so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and in just a minute, we will get back to last night's debate and talk about the optics of the debate. What did it look like with the sound off, and did that matter? Stay with us.